to the National Intel Report, but alas, there is no John Stadmiller today. He asked me sort of at the last minute to fill in today. My name's Clint. You might remember me from being around here for a while. Last couple of years, had a show just after John's, a little show called The Corporation Nation. It's Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016. We are live today. Gonna talk to you today a little bit about one of my passions, which is vaccines. I have a guest that hopefully is going to be joining me in the second hour to talk about the wonderful, wonderful world of exemptions and all the fees and everything and all of the trouble that vaccine companies are getting in behind the scenes that, of course, we don't hear about. But, hey, I'd like to welcome you. As far as vaccines go, I made a movie. I had cancer when I was 17 years old, and I really wanted to know what the hell happened to a 17-year-old kid just about to graduate high school, promising careers ahead of him. What the hell happened? Suddenly I'm growing up, and suddenly I get a cancer, a form of extremely rare form of cancer that actually only appears in people that are either over the age of 75 or people with an autoimmune deficiency syndrome, which is codename AIDS. These are the people that this form of cancer was appearing as. And lucky old me, I got it. Big old bump on my tongue. Had to take a bunch of my tongue out to get rid of the cancerous cells. Fortunately, I was not a victim of any of the other forms of quote unquote treatment that we implement today. But I always, I always was wondering what the hell could cause such an effect. What is it that could possibly have, caused a little kid just to get cancer? What's causing two out of three children before the age of 18 to express some form of carcinogenesis, some form of growth that is not natural to the to the cells in the body, some sort of reprogramming that's happening of these basically intelligent little computer chips that are saying, hey, let's grow in a way that is not functionally, correct for, let's grow some lung cells in the kidneys, or let's grow some pancreas cells in the testicles, and let's grow some... This is what's happening, is this sort of reprogramming. And I, as I started looking into what the causes of cancer are, of course, you come across all kinds of different aspects, but the one thing that kept coming back was vaccines. Vaccines as the cause of cancer. And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today, about my journey as, almost 5 years ago now, did all the research, so that's been 7 years since I've been, 8 years since I've been researching in vaccines, and made a little documentary called Lethal Injection. It's been viewed about 140,000 times and has been copied over many, many, many other times. All my work has always been free. Highly recommend you see that. And then, consider what you just saw, because when you have the Salk and the Sabin, both of whom created both the sugar cube and the and the live virus vaccine for polio, both coming out and admitting that not only did the vaccines not work, but they actually were causing cases of polio, paralytic polio in children, where cases were as high as, I think it was 77% of the population that was developing this paralytic form of polio had undergone three vaccinations. These are congressional records, amazingly, just out in the open everywhere. Lots of information like that. But I wanted to talk about, in a more general way, without all the terms of art, with all of the science, just in a general way, what I've discovered is actually happening in the body. There's several things that are happening through the vaccination process. Now, when you look at the ingredient list of the vaccine, you have many, many, many things going on in there. But the most concerning aspect of the ingredients in the vaccines are, in fact, the live and dead tissue, some of it cloned, that is actually being used to grow the cell substrates for the vaccines. I can't stress this enough. One of the most shocking aspects of this was to find out that they had been cloning aborted fetal tissue taken from the Wistar Institute, and they actually refer to the aborted fetal human fetal tissue as Wistar Institute WI-256 or whatever the actual code is that you can actually read in these vaccine inserts. And I was just so taken aback and shocked that we were actually injecting human parts, proteins, and DNA into our own bodies, which, you know, I don't know how to say this except to explain, again, as we're going to talk about, what that's actually doing in the body. And I realized that this is a new sort of, if you will, form of cannibalism. Right, we're not actually eating babies. We're not actually eating our sacrifices or participating in cannibalism as we understand it, and as we've been shown it in the in the wild, if you will. But we're actually injecting. We're injecting proteins and DNA and blood and all sorts of different things, not only of the human body, foreign bodies, different blood types, etc., but also the animal and insect and plant world. We're actually injecting what can only be called, in my opinion, a new instruction manual, a new instruction set, into the system, into the human system. It goes and it affects the epigenome, starts flipping on what we call switches that will do all sorts of different things in different combinations, kind of like when your garage clicker only works for your garage door. Well, there's a certain amount of switches that are switched that make that signal, that communication device, only communicate with a specific garage door opener on your block, which is your own. Your key in your car is another example. Your clicker for your car, when you push it, it only activates and communicates with the things it's supposed to communicate with what it's programmed to communicate. But then all of a sudden, you're injecting a whole plethora of animal species into your children and into yourself, all with different RNA and DNA compounds. And you have to understand that RNA and DNA are actually competing, if you will, life forms. The RNA is what actually copies and mimics and reproduces the DNA. The RNA and DNA, RNA was around long before DNA ever came around, as far as I understand. And this is very frightening when you consider, again, the first real big case, of course, that everybody's probably heard of when it comes to the cancer, quote-unquote, virus, which is a very loose term, was the SV40 that came, that they were using the monkey kidney virus that they were harvesting. They were growing the cell substrates again very crudely by mincing up some kidney liver, I believe it was, kidneys and livers, excuse me, but mostly the kidneys. And all of a sudden you had this outbreak, as was predicted by certain doctors, of a massive cancer epidemic. You have certain doctors back in the early 1900s exclaiming that they had never seen any kind of cancers before until the cattle had been started to had been vaccinated. Not a single case of cancer, and when there was a case of cancer, it was a vaccinated cattle when that first started coming around. Very, very, very disturbing statistics when you look at the SV40 or simian virus number 40. And, of course, simian virus number 40 is mass-produced. You got to understand, folks, simian, look it up. Simian virus number 40 is something you can go and buy. Okay, this is something that's used a lot in the medical industry, even though they know it's a cancer-causing agent. And you find a lot of different cases, a lot of different forms of cancer where SV40 is actually present in the cancer cells when they actually do the testing, which is not, unfortunately, very often. What's happened is that society has somehow taken to the notion that all of this disease, dis-ease. Do you know that Dante in his Inferno and his series of books, dis was actually the name of the devil for Dante. Dante listed the word D-I-S capitalized as the name of the devil. And if you think about what that means when we say things such as dis-ease, disposition, disposal, all these different words that begin with dis, it's always sort of a negative context if you think about it. So if we're in a legal disposition, well, think about it. You can't really be in a natural disposition. That would just be your normal state. So you would never add a dis-ease if you're in your natural element. You'd be healthy. You'd be, you know, you'd be at ease, in other words. And you also find this in the legal realm where the notion of being put into dis-ease is what a mortgage is what a citizenship is, and all these different things. So it's anything that basically redirects you from your natural path, your natural course. Discourse is another dis word of the devil. And ironically, not surprisingly, but sort of ironically, they still call the trade of attorneys back Scottish and in the Parliament there, they call it devilry. You can look up devilry in the legal books, and it'll tell you. You can look up devil's advocate. You can look up all those things. But a devil is basically attorney. A devil is actually an apprentice, and a devil master is actually an attorney that offers their services for free. As a devil's advocate, devil's teacher, basically, they call him a devil master. So it's very interesting when you start getting into what the artifice is, what artificial things are, and what this word dis-ease, dismemberment, dis-this, dis-that. Very interesting. And so we're talking about what puts us at a state of dis-ease. Disease has become a common word, as if it's not, you know, as if it's just somehow normal, as if we expect disease to happen as a normal, you know, part of society. We treat the cures, as they call them, the treatment for disease, we treat that as normal. Sure, it's absolutely normal to irradiate people and food and animals and whatever. It's perfectly normal to inject a vaccine into. Of course, that's what God intended, right? Huh, yeah. Very strange. Very strange when you start thinking about that. So I want people to understand. I want to give you a couple examples of what vaccines have done to generations after generations and after generations of people. Now, in my documentary, I talk about a little thing called adjuvants. Adjuvants, you've heard of the mercury adjuvants. You've probably heard that they replaced mercury with something even worse, which is aluminum. Aluminum happens to be one of those special metals that actually signal to cross the blood-brain barrier and, of course, piggyback disease upon it. But I wanted to really make people understand. They use other things. Now, in the Gulf War, for the anthrax, the experimental anthrax vaccines that they fast-tracked for our soldiers, they used something called squalene. Squalene, according to Dr. Matsumoto in his book Vaccine A, actually calls it the most insidious chemical weapon ever devised. And I want to tell you that these ingredients in these vaccines are indeed chemical biological weapons. Let's think about that phrase. What is a biological weapon? Well, it would be anything that puts your body at dis-ease. Anything that would cause your body to do something that it doesn't normally do. For instance, cancer. But most importantly, why squalene was called by many researchers and doctors the most insidious biological weapon ever created, let me tell you about it. Now, if you look up squalene, you can find, even on the CDC website, you can find that they admit, yes, absolutely, we harvest squalene from sharks. It's used, it's the same supplement that's used that you can ingest as a supplement. And squalene is a part of your own body. It is something that your body creates naturally. And the best description of it really is that it's the lubricant for your joints and your muscles. It's literally like putting oil in your car. So if you mess up that system, you can imagine what's going to happen as far as the symptoms of dis-ease, right? If all of a sudden your body's not being lubricated correctly, well, that's what squalene does in the human body. It is something that is naturally produced. It's in all of your joints and your cartilages and everything else. So what happens when you actually vaccinate? And all vaccination really means is that you're bypassing the body's natural defenses and injecting something right into the bloodstream. Now, of course, injecting a disease into the body does cause an immune response. That is a true statement, and that is the only statement that actually describes what a vaccine is intended to do, to create an immune response, to create antibodies, right? Even if it's just one antibody above normal, hey, we've had a successful vaccine. What about all the other hundreds of ingredients that are in the vaccines, for instance, the adjuvants like squalene? Now, squalene has, the adjuvants have absolutely nothing to do with the purpose or the stated purpose of the vaccine. Adjuvants are called the dirty little secret of vaccines, which basically means that back in the day, before they had all this modern research, they found out that the vaccines that were tainted, that were corrupted, that were polluted, that didn't get sterilized as well, that had dirt in them, essentially, were the ones that would cause an immune response. Had nothing to do with what you were actually trying to get a response to. It would just cause the body to react more. And so they called it an adjuvant. And they used certain things like aluminum, you know, things that make your body very upset. We're going to be talking about what that actually does to your body when we come back. Stay tuned, folks. Alright, folks, welcome back here on the National Intel Report. I'm hosting for Mr. Stadtmiller today. My name is Clint Richardson. I'm talking about vaccines today. Again, we're going to have a guest. Actually, just tried to call me, but I couldn't answer the phone. It's sort of a last-minute deal. Alan is actually an attorney, and he specializes in in a vaccine right. In fact, his website is vaccineright.com, where he has a lot of good information. We'll get him on in the second hour. But back to this notion of what actually, why should we be wanting exemptions from vaccines? Why should we be concerned? Well, yeah. After many years, and over a decade of research, I believe at this point, for myself, I uncovered some very brutal understandings, and when applying them to society and the illness, the disease that you see all around you, it certainly starts to make sense, all the dementia and everything else. But so squalene, again, something harvested from sharks, something that actually is produced in our bodies and in every living body. You can take it as a health supplement. When you ingest it, though, you, of course, have all the wonderful barriers and blocks and immune shields from that actually going. And in other words, it's something that's happening naturally. It's what your body expects going through your stomach. It siphons through, disposes of what it doesn't need. But when you inject something directly into the body, directly into the bloodstream, that is an instant infection, a period, end of story. You've just infected your body. All right, it's going into the musculature. It's going into the blood and the serum. It's literally an infection. Now your body sees that, and your cells make a phone call. They send out little proteins that go and alert the immune system, which is generally in the spine, and it your body then has an immune response, just as they want your body to have. It's the whole point of the adjuvant. Now, this immune response, of course, is to the squalene. It's not to the flu or to the anthrax or to anything. No, this is to the squalene. So what happens? Well, your body sees something that's very similar to what it creates and what it has a whole functionality to produce. So what does it do? Well, unfortunately, it starts creating antibodies against squalene. Well, wait a minute. How does it differentiate between shark cartilage, shark squalene, and human, the human form, the human-produced squalene? And the answer is it can't. And this is where we get some of the symptoms of Gulf War syndrome, as they called it. Still being denied. This is where we get many of the problems, because all of a sudden your body is fighting against something that it produces, thinking that that it's an infection, thinking that it's something invading the body, and your body now is producing antibodies against the very substance that your body needs. Now imagine your joints all of a sudden not being able to be lubricated because you got a vaccine with an adjuvant that is specifically designed to cause antibodies against the very thing that's being injected. I want you to think about that, folks. I want you to think about all the people with all the health issues out there, all the arthritis and all of the different forms of joint and muscle aches, and you'll start to understand just what the hell's happening in people's bodies. Now, this is just one microcosm example of many, many different forms of disease that are being caused not by necessarily an infection of some disease, but by an infection of a similitude, something that is not the same but is similar, that causes the body to see it as foreign enough from a different animal, for instance, as foreign enough to actually cause a concern and cause a chain reaction, because your body's not, it's smart, but it's not, you know, it doesn't sit there and think about it. But it's enough to cause a chain reaction in your body. And all of a sudden, your body is fighting itself. Well, imagine all the different ingredients, all the different parts, the liver, the stomach, the blood. Imagine all the different parts that are being injected into you from different animals and from a human aborted fetal tissue. And imagine what your body is producing antibodies for. Imagine the war that's going on in your body from all of these different ingredients, all these different proteins that shouldn't be in your body. We'll be back. All right, folks, welcome back. You're in the National Intel Report. I'm Clint, doing a little substitute hosting for John, who couldn't make it in today. I want to tell you about a few more little aspects of this vaccine thing. Now, I really want to get it across to you, folks. Whichever part of the body, whichever fluid of the body that you're pumping into your body, of some foreign body, and you know, think, go back to the Bible, go back to all the ancient wisdom and all the ancient scripture, which just means ancient knowledge. Go back to all the old writings that are expressly forbid in every way, shape, or form, the admixing of species, what we do as normal today in our scientific, which is a loose term, again, nothing to do with the scientific method, just an institution called science. What we're doing today in the mix and crossbreeding of species is so absolutely evil, it cannot even be expressed. And what we are experiencing is the result of that evil, of the fact that we're not paying attention to these ancient warnings that no doubt, it's not a new thing that's happening. You think about it. But we're ignoring all of that ancient wisdom, ancient knowledge that says do not cross species. Do not put pieces of DNA into your body. Do not. Absolutely. This is why the story of the flood came along. We got to, you know, we've experimented. We've crossed species. Now we got to destroy the experiment. Well, gosh, folks, I don't know what the flood's going to be, but there's certainly going to be some wrath coming along for all of this that we've allowed to happen to ourselves, for all this cross-species contamination. I want to read you, this is straight out of the U.S. Geological Survey. Again, you can see this in my documentary, which is called Lethal Injection, The Story of Vaccination, on YouTube for free, or on my website, The Corporation Nation. Remember, all my work is free. Never made a cent from it. How PCP works. What is PCP? PCP. Well, up in the Aztec Islands, up in the after they passed the Burroughs Act, the Free Roaming Wild Horses and Burroughs Act, because they said there was just too many wild horses. You know, that symbol of America, that beauty, that wonder of America. Yeah, we got to start killing them damn things off. Either got to capture them and have people adopt them, or we're gonna sterilize them. Well, how many times have you heard on all the shock jock radio shows about the 90% aspect of population control? We're gonna deflate the population by 90%, get it around the 500,000 mark, and all should be good, right? Well, that's exactly what the goal of the U.S. Geological Survey was when they were given the power to start sterilizing species. Their goal was 90%, and they achieved that goal. How did they do it? Now, we're all looking for some chemical, some creation, some concoction of that's unique and there's no folks. See, this is not the point. The point is not to get all these. You know, yeah, sure, they'll get little unique or novel things into you, but they don't have to do that. If they want to sterilize you, here's all they have to do. Okay, this is how PZP or porcine zona pellucida. This is the ovary of a pig. All they got to do is take a piece of protein, the DNA from the ovary, and inject it into you, and they will cause you sterilization. Why? Because the pig ovary is very, very similar. They use pigs a lot because pigs are very similar to the human makeup. All they need is a piece of pig, and it will cause, just like with the squalene, it will cause a chain reaction in your body. Your body will start producing antibodies against spermatogenesis and against the notion of a woman getting pregnant, which it'll explain here. In order for a sperm to attach to the ovum and fertilize the egg, there must be complementary proteins on both the surface of the sperm and the zona pellucida, or ZP, of the ovum. A PZP, or porcine zona pellucida, acts as a foreign protein against which the treated mare, the horse, produces antibodies. And this is for humans, too. Trust in any animal that you cross species. Thus, the PZP fertility control agent is actually a vaccine, according to the U.S. Geological Survey site that I'm reading from. These antibodies, okay, attached to the mare's, the horse's, zona sperm receptors, all right? So you have foreign proteins. They attach as in basically an infection, and your body starts fighting it. The antibodies attach the mare's zona sperm receptors on the ovum and block fertilization. Domestic pig ovaries obtained from just your ordinary slaughterhouses are minced, and the PZP is obtained from screening filtration. An adjuvant is mixed with the PZP to enhance its effectiveness when it is injected into mares intramuscularly. Once injected, it causes an immune response, making the mare infertile. Over time, the antibody titers fall and fertility may return. With the liquid vaccine, a booster injection be given at 10 months to raise the titers back to the infertile range. This can be done each year for at least 4 years, after which time the effects may be more likely to become permanent. But for this reason, current individual-level field trials involve only 1 to 4 years of treatment. This is basically telling you that they've been successful. This is old. This is very old. In a 90% reduction of fertility in the wild horse population up there in the Assateague region, the Assateague Island Reserve. And I want you to think about this again. All it is a piece of the animal, or human, but in this case animal, that is so similar, but yet so different, that the body is confused and it literally starts producing antibodies to the very functionality of our own body. It starts fighting the chemicals that we produce. It starts fighting the proteins that we produce. It starts ripping apart the hairs on the sperm. It starts doing things. It prevents the bridges from being built from the cells in the sperm so that the sperm can never swim. I want you folks to understand that this is what's been happening. And again, don't stop here. Think about it, man. What is used in vaccine production? You got rabbit kidneys. You got monkey kidneys. You got monkey. You got lung tissue. You've got pancreas tissue. You've got blood and blood serum. Anytime you see serum, that's usually blood, plasma. All these different aspects that we are cross-contaminating into our bodies voluntarily, and we wonder why it is that we are falling apart. We wonder why it is that we seem to be getting early onset diseases like Alzheimer's in our children. We wonder why it is that we're all sick. These things don't just happen overnight. Some of these things, I should say. We also have what they used to refer to as, the correct term is slow virus. This is what they actually refer to with prions. Prions is something that I've researched to the extreme. I found out that all the modern dementia diseases are likely, very likely, in fact, I bet my life on it at this point, that the prions, which are proteins, again, prions are something that happens naturally in your body. You have prions. They protect your cells. They are there as the protectors against such things as cancer. They prevent, by their little locking mechanisms, disease. And so we find that with prions, and let me read you the definition of a prion here. And a prion disease is the same thing as mad cow disease or a spongiform encephalopathy. Excuse me, where you have holes in your brain because these prions, they line up with each other and they infect each other, and so your brain turns into Swiss cheese. When they do autopsies, for instance, on people with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig's, the ALS. Well, guess what they find? They find Swiss cheese in people's brains. They find prions that have been misformed, misfolded. You could call that evolution or devolution. Okay, that's what folding means. So they're literally causing an evolution or a de-evolution, if you will, by infectious prions, which would be the scrappy from sheep, which is a disease, and there's also chronic wasting syndrome. This is another form of prion disease that you find in deer, which just happens to be exactly what happens to AIDS patients. They have a chronic fatigue and a chronic wasting syndrome where their body can't hold muscle. Well, that just happens to be the same exact thing in a deer in prion disease. And we're taking those and we're injecting them into our bodies. What is a prion? Any of the various infectious proteins that are abnormal, forms of normal cellular proteins that proliferate by inducing the normal protein to convert to the abnormal form. Well, if I'm a scrappy protein, a prion protein, and I come across a human protein, I'm going to want to change that human protein into the only thing I know, which is scrappy, which is the infectious version of sheep. You see, again, it's a reprogramming. You got to consider your body as an intelligent machine. It has switches that cause different forms of disease to manifest, or symptoms of disease to manifest. And those symptoms are then what precursors you to be susceptible to other diseases. And this is very important, because another thing I found out that really blew my mind was that when we vaccinate, we are actually preventing symptoms of disease. We're not preventing any disease. A disease cannot be prevented. It's an impossibility. To have the disease in you is an infection. It is a disease. But what can be, and what is happening, let's say with the measles, the chicken pops, and all these childhood diseases that are actually very important parts of life that should not be avoided, what's happening is that the vaccines are causing the symptoms to not manifest. Well, guess what? If the symptoms of chickenpox and the symptoms, which are the rashes and the bumps and the sickness, the illness, if those symptoms don't manifest, well, then the genome and the epigenome it's not getting the correct signals. It's not getting the right reaction in the body to flip those switches in your childhood that actually make you immune to certain other diseases like cancers. They say that you're 2,000% more likely to develop certain types of cancer if you do not express the symptoms of measles but are infected with measles. You see, you got to start rethinking things. These reactions we have, these illnesses, the heat of the fever and these sorts of things, those are specifically there to fight the disease. So are the symptoms of these childhood diseases. If you're actually injecting something to cause the lack of symptom expression, then you're actually preventing the expression of that which will protect you from future disease. So there is a goal, a very clandestine and hidden goal with these things. None of this is good. None of this is a good thing. And I really want you to know, folks, your elderly parents or your young children who are suffering from these early onset deficiencies, early onset Alzheimer's and these types, these are prion diseases. These are the misfolding of the very thing that protects you from disease in the first place. A prion, to convert to abnormal form, and that in mammals includes pathogenic forms which arise sporadically as a result of genetic mutation or the transmission, as by ingestion or vaccination, of infected tissue, and which upon accumulation in the brain cause a prion disease. Now, I'm not convinced in any way, shape, or form that mad cow disease is caused by eating. I don't think most of these types of diseases that affect the inner systems are caused by something you eat. It's a direct bodily injection of stuff that's just not supposed to be in your body. From the Concise Encyclopedia, disease-causing agent is a prion discovered by Stanley Prisoner, responsible for various fetal neurodegenerative diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. Again, Swiss cheese of the brain. An abnormal form of a normally harmless protein found in mammals and birds, the disease-causing prion can enter the brain through infection. Folks, how are you infected? Think about that for a moment. It's always something that enters in through a cut, in through a sting of a wasp, or in through a needle from the worst kind of wasp, which is a nurse that has no frickin' clue about what she's injecting into you. All right, it's always something that's always, you're always stung. Remember that. That's where these diseases come from. It can arise from a mutation in the gene that encodes for the protein. Remember, it's all about communication. Once present in the brain, it causes normal proteins to refold into the abnormal shape. As prion proteins multiply, they accumulate within nerve cells, destroying them and eventually causing brain tissue to become riddled with holes. Diseases caused by prions includes Christoph-Jakob's disease. You may have heard of that. Also, the human form, which is, that is the human form of bad cow disease, and scrappy, as we talked about, which is in sheep. Prions are unlike all other known disease-causing organisms, as they appear to lack a nucleic acid, DNA, or RNA, in other words. Now, they first got discovered in Papua New Guinea, where we found out that the Japanese have been injecting these people in a test with this new virus. They thought that it was from cannibalism, from the women eating the brains of the dead. That's one form called kuru. You might have heard about it. You can look at documentaries about the kuru. It literally turns people into zombies because they lose control of their brains, of their neural pathways. And that's exactly what's happening to our elderly and to our youth because of vaccination. We'll be back, folks. Tuned into the National Intel Report. John's absent today. My name's Clint. I'm just filling in. Gonna have a guest after the break, which I'm very excited about. We'll be talking about vaccine exemptions. We'll also be talking about the incredibly, incredibly twisted world of the fines and the fees and the sheer nightmarish amount of money that is spent on people who actually, which is very a small percentage of the actual victims of vaccines that actually file claims in the VIRS that actually report the incidents and actually, you know, enter these class action lawsuits, which, anyway, it's just amazing the amount of money that goes, which is the perfect, of course, way of showing the dangers of vaccines, how many people are harmed by them, but it just doesn't make the mainstream news, of course. As far as this prion thing, again, we're talking about xenotransplantation. Xenotransplantation or allotransplantation is, again, that very, very, very dangerous aspect of, well, what is xenotransplantation? The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, wants you to know from their website that the co-culture of human embryos with non-human animal cells raises health concerns for the recipients of such embryos, the offspring resulting from such embryos, and the general public. The use of non-human animal cells, tissues, and organs in the treatment of human medical conditions is called xenotransplantation. I have a friend who has a pig vein, a replacement for the human vein in his arm, Who knows what kind of havoc that would actually cause, just as an example of what gene or allotransplantation is. Co-culture of human embryos and non-human animal cells fits the second part of this definition. During co-culturing, human embryos and non-human animal cells are maintained together outside the body in ex vivo contact. Thus, the woman into whom the co-cultured embryos are transferred is a recipient of a xenotransplantation product. Excuse me. Now, this covers, of course, the any form of animal DNA being purposefully placed into the human body, especially that which is vaccinated, again, to bypass all of the important safeguards. A serious concern regarding the clinical use of xenotransplantation is the potential for the transmission of infectious disease from non-human animals to humans. Scientists believe that the potential for transmission of infectious disease from the animal source to a human is of concern. Oh, thanks, FDA. What would we do without you? Either when live non-human animal cells, tissues, or organs are implanted directly into a human, or when human cells are exposed to live non-human animal cells by ex vivo contact. Experience with organ allotransplantation has shown that diseases such as human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV infection, Christoph-Jakob's disease, again, prion disease, hepatitis B virus infection, and hepatitis C virus infection can be transmitted from the human donor to the recipient, vice versa. These concerns may extend beyond the recipient to the general public because of the potential for subsequent transmission of infectious agents to the recipient's contacts and to the general population, not to mention your children. What's incredible about prions is they can sit in your body for 50 years and never be activated until they're activated. They are virtually indestructible, very frightening, and that's what's being passed on through vaccination. We'll be back, folks. Stay tuned. The National Intel Report. Again, John Stadtmiller couldn't make it in today, so I'm Clint Richardson filling in. You can again see my websites, the realityblogger.wordpress.com and the corporationnation.com. My new website, strawmanstory.info. And finally, the old radio archives. You can find, of course, here at RBN for the Corporation Nation, or you can go to corporationnationradioarchives.wordpress.com. And they're all there, including all the new shows I'm doing, like this one. So, with that said, very important guest tonight, Alan Phillips, who's a juris doctor and attorney at law. His website is vaccinerights.com, and he focuses specifically on exemptions, a lot of other research, and very, very, very good resources on this website. Again, vaccinerights.com, very simple. Also, we'll talk about the book that is Vaccine Legal Exemptions by our guest, Alan Phillips. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are very confused about this notion of the exemption process. Of course, the religion, always one of the top, top players when it comes to exemptions, amazingly so. But there's so many other forms of exemptions. But let's... how did you get into to being an advocate for this particular subject?
Well, I mean, it's a good question because there's any number of huge problems on the planet today that one could be invested in to one degree or another, and I try to keep up to a little bit with many of them. But my oldest son, who's 22 now, when he was born, a friend of mine said that she had another friend who had a kid who had been permanently disabled by a vaccine, and I had never heard of that, and I was just sort of shocked. What? People can be hurt by a vaccine? And so I did a little research, and long story short, I was just compelled by the issue. And I actually went back to school after being out for 17 years and picked law school because of this issue. It was just so compelling to me, and I just really have never looked back. I started researching and writing on the issue, and then in more recent years have been focused on working with people all over the country to help them legally avoid immunizations in a variety of different contexts. There's about a dozen or more contexts and subcontexts, sort of depends on how you count. But it's not just school and daycare, which, of course, is the area most people think of when you first mention the subject. But vaccines are required in the military for immigrants, increasingly as a condition of employment. So far, that's mostly healthcare workers, but we're going to see that spread to child care workers. We're already seeing that, California and some other parts of the country. Basically, everybody's got a target on their back, and there's always another vaccine to give a person, and there's always another person to give a vaccine. And if you want to, you know, think of those two little pieces, that's really the best way to summarize the pharmaceutical industry's goal. It's an open-ended goal with no real end point in sight.
Well, there is that notion in America, we have this sort of goal of unlimited expansion with nowhere to go. It's a very strange concept. You know, we always have to grow. The cities have to grow 7%, da da da. It's kind of ridiculous when you start looking at it, and it's like, where exactly are we going to go? But you have a lot of different listings here, which I had not really considered. Parents, students, immigrants, military, employees, international travelers, schools, agencies, and attorneys are the last one, which I had not considered as a special group. Is there some pressure from the bar either way when it comes to attorneys?
Yeah, that particular listing really refers to, for example, adoption agencies may encounter clients who don't want to vaccinate. I've never had somebody from the agency contact me and say, how do I handle this? Although I have parents all the time saying, you know, the agency says I have to get a vaccine to adopt the child. You know, is there a legal way out of that? Attorneys, it's just that it's... You know, I found myself saying a lot lately that I'm not smarter than other attorneys. I just happen to be the only one in the country whose practice is focused on this issue. And it's like any other specialization in law or anywhere else. If you are focused on something over a long period of time, there's a good chance you're going to gradually see more and more into it, have more insights, more experience, more just overall ability to work and, in my case, help people in that arena. So... there's a fairly significant part of my practice that is advising other attorneys around the country when their client wants to avoid vaccines. And most often I see that in the family law arena where parents will split up and one of them wants to vaccinate the kids and the other one doesn't. And it turns out there are legal arguments that are unique to vaccines that family law attorneys just don't think of or see because they're not accustomed to looking at the issue. And after looking at it for a few years, some of these different approaches sort of dawned on me. And so it didn't, you know, come to me quickly either. But so I help attorneys a lot with their clients.
Makes sense. It's a, you know, it's a hell of a specialty, and I'm sure that you've made some very interesting quote-unquote without expanding on it, enemies for being in this particular forefront of the legal realm, because I mean, this is, you know, there's been a lot of efforts to essentially hide this information. It's always public information, but just because something's public doesn't mean it's easy to find.
Yeah, let me give you a really curious and also disturbing example of it. A big part of what I do with this vaccine issue week to week involves working with legislative activists, and I've heard several occasions where people talk about how there will be medical doctors getting up in front of a legislative health committee and they're promoting the pro-vaccine view, and yet many of them have literally never heard of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, for example. And it's understandable because it's only been around for 30 years, and so, you know, that's not long enough for anybody to really learn about it. I mean, it's just, you know, you got to find your humor where you can on such an otherwise dark issue. But how can somebody who claims to be an expert on vaccines not know about the Injury Compensation Program? The act was passed in 1986. The program started paying out in 1989. It's paid out, as you know, over $3.3 billion now. And over the last 6 years in particular, the rates jumped, and it's been something on the order of about, on average, over the last 6 years, about $227 million a year. That's twice or more than twice the average over the life of the entire program, now in its 26th year of paying out. And if those numbers aren't scary enough, there are multiple governmental and non-governmental agencies that estimate the reported serious adverse events amount to maybe between 1 and 10% of what really goes on in the world. So the really big piece to take away from all these numbers there is that we don't have any real data at all on the true scope of vaccine injury and death. What we have are people from the CDC and FDA, from the National Vaccine Information Center, a nonprofit grassroots organization, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. Those are the ones I know off the top of my head that all estimate 1 to 10% of the serious vaccine adverse events get reported. So that means that 90 to 99% don't. So there's this huge unknown. So anytime somebody says to you, well, yeah, there's the occasional problem, but, you know, look at this wonderful net benefit. It's worth, you know, sacrificing a few innocent children because look at all the children who are being saved. Well, we have no idea if there's a net benefit or not. There's no data available from which to make that calculation.
Well, like the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is VICP, there's also the VERS, which is, I'm trying to remember my acronyms, but I mean, most people don't know that exists, that there's actually a place to go and report in injuries. So if you're not publicizing that, if you're not making that something that is a knowable fact, well, then how in the heck did you possibly have people apply for the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program if they don't even know where to report their side effects?
Right. And so there's two separate programs there, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Now, it's real interesting the way the laws are written on this. They don't tell, first of all, doctors are required by federal law to report suspected adverse events, but it's not about whether the doctor's opinion is that it might be an adverse event. The law is written in a certain way. If certain conditions happen within 7 days after a vaccine, they have to be reported, whether the doctor thinks it had anything to do with the vaccine or not. If any of the conditions that are on the package inserts of the vaccines that are listed as possible adverse events, if any of those show up, the doctors have to report them. But what we find through surveys, that the vast majority of doctors are not reporting this. Now, they can do this despite a federal law because there's nothing in the law that creates a penalty if they don't do it. So it's sort of like, yeah, it's law, but, you know, honor system here, guys. And, of course, nobody's doing it because there is tremendous pressure from the pharmaceutical industry to toe the party line here, promote vaccines, don't ever say anything out loud that would be contrary to maximizing the profits from the sale of vaccines.
You have groups as well that are generally government funded. One of the classic examples is the military, where these guys are actually, not only are they afraid to refuse, because that, but they're afraid to report their adverse conditions even to their CEO, their superior officer, excuse me. So these guys are scared to death to appear, you know, like a wimp or like because there's so much pressure to not actually report. And again, it's you know, whether it's ignorance or it's peer pressure, as you're talking about, a lot of times government funded jobs that require these vaccines, there's a lot of that type of pressure too, and it's pretty pathetic when you really consider.
Yeah, I've had and seen situations where say there's a whole family going overseas because a mother or father, a member of the military, is being transferred overseas, and if the military is going to transfer the family along with the military member, then the whole family has to get vaccinated. And I've seen situations where the military member says, I'm not going to fight this. I'm going to go ahead and get my vaccines, but can you help my family get an exemption? And it's kind of telling. You know, it just sort of speaks to what you were just saying. The pressure there is tremendous, and a lot of people don't want vaccines but won't stand up to it, even if there is a legal right. And there's no judgment here on my part with respect to any given individual. You know, everybody has to, you know, make that decision for themselves. And this happens all the time with healthcare workers where, sure, they could hire an attorney to help them and in many cases have a really good chance of succeeding if it's approached correctly from the start. And yet a lot of them just don't even want to ask for the exemption. They're afraid that there will be some form of retaliation, they'll lose their job or something. And it's not that they necessarily could legally retaliate, but how are you going to prove it was because you asked for an exemption?
Well, you know, they had to close a whole hospital floor here at the local hospital here in Utah, in Salt Lake, because so many nurses refused to vaccinate themselves that they had to fire them all for some reason. So, I mean, yeah, talk about pressure. I mean, what a to close an entire hospital wing just to get you know, conformity is very frightening.
And in this case, with the flu vaccine, it's got to be the stupidest excuse for a vaccine, with a possible exception of vaccinating newborn children with the hepatitis B vaccine. Because I'll tell you, I can count on one hand the number of newborn children I've ever heard of who were sexually promiscuous intravenous drug users.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, somebody said that they asked a nurse once, well, why do we vaccinate newborn children with a hepatitis B? And the nurse's answer is very telling. She says, because that's what we do. Mm. Oh, yeah. It must be. I saw this on a website once. Everybody does this, so it must be important, right? Oh, yeah, that's why we do it. Okay, thank you. Now I feel much better.
Absolutely. Scary.
Oh, yeah. Scary. Maybe scariest, maybe even the understatement. But just a couple of real quick pieces of information here, because the flu vaccine is so absurd. There was actually a study just under a year ago in Canada. They found that the flu vaccine was -8% effective. -8. In other words, you're more likely to get the flu if you got the vaccine.
Which it actually warns you about in the vaccine insert. You might develop the flu.
Yep. You might also be permanently disabled or killed. They may or may not mention that in the package insert. But there was, I think it was about a recent 10-year period where it was really, really close to 40% of the total vaccines administered in the U.S. over this, you know, multi-year period. 40% of them were flu vaccines. You know, more than any other vaccine, almost as many as all the rest of them put together, right? And this is because everybody is supposed to get a flu shot anywhere from 6 months old to, I think you're supposed to keep getting flu shots until you've been dead for 6 months or something close to that. You know, it might as well be, right, because of the pressure. But here's a study that says you're more likely to get the flu if you get the shot. And even the CDC, you know, the last couple of flu seasons has admitted very, very low efficacy rates, you know, in the low 20s or in the teens. And their excuse is, well, you know, little protection is better than none. The problem is, remember that 40% who are getting the flu shots? Well, they were something on the order of about 57% of the payouts for vaccine injury and death from the federal government were because of flu vaccine injuries and deaths. So I don't know if that means flu vaccines are, you know, are more dangerous than other vaccines, or just that those cases are easier to win. But this is a deadly vaccine.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't think people think about the ingredients. The adjuvants and all that stuff is really where it's all at. But real quick, you have a graph on your website which is labeled pharmaceutical fines that are greater than $100 million, which, what we're talking about is basically an excuse. You know, you pay your fine, you get off the hook for maiming and killing a bunch of people. When we come back from the break here, let's talk about what these fines are, because in the millions of dollars, hundreds of million dollars, there are years where it goes up to $6,000 million. Of course, billion dollars. We'll be back, folks. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Here in the National Intel Report, this is Clint filling in for John today. Our special guest is Alan Phillips, an attorney and counselor at law who specializes in, and from what I understand, one of the only or the only actual specialist in this crazy field of vaccinations and exemptions. VaccineRights.com, folks. VaccineRights.com. We'll talk about the book that you can get here real quick. But first, I wanted to talk about these. It's just so amazing to me. I'm looking at this schedule of fees, fines that were imposed upon, according to the Department of Justice, imposed upon pharmaceutical companies, of course. And up until, you know, from 2001 to about 2008, you stayed pretty much below or just at the $1 billion mark. And all of a sudden, 2009, which just happens to be the year when the when a lot of the controversy that we hear started coming out, a lot of the sterilization issues, the abortive functionality of the flu vaccine, because that is actually when they combined the emergency swine flu experimental vaccine in with the regular flu vaccine. So all of a sudden, you see this spike in of $3 billion of fines to the pharmaceutical companies in 2009. I find that kind of a little coinkydink. I'm sure there's more behind it. And then from that point on, you know, nothing really below $2 billion going on. And in 2012, we have a $6 billion year. Pretty profitable for government, wasn't it?
Yeah, now keep in mind, this graph is only looking at the fines that were greater than $100 million. So I didn't even get into the $60, $80, $10 million ones, the $900,000 or whatever. And I have no idea, but there certainly are lots of those out there. And how that would affect the totals on this particular graph, I have no idea. But you raise a really good point that you know, for several years, what is this, about 8 years, it was more or less level, and probably averaging, it looks like it would be under the $1 billion level, total combined greater than $100 million fines, and all of a sudden in the last several years, now 2014 was a really low year, but the last several years, you know, multi-billions of dollars adding these large fines together. And now the individual fines here represent a combination of criminal and civil fines. And sometimes there's a subdivision of that, and other times there either isn't or it wasn't in the information that I've found. But there have been at least two times where companies had $1 billion with a B as in baby boy, $1 billion criminal fines. And I got to clarify the difference here in just general terms between a civil fine and a criminal fine. You don't get a criminal fine or a criminal conviction unless you knew what you were doing when you did it, and you did it anyway. Now, if you accidentally screw up, you may still be liable for the harm you caused, but that would be a civil fine. That would be negligence, you know, something, you know, not with deliberate malicious intent. And the next comment I want to make here, Clint, really is speculative, but it's not like it's out of left field. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there's really three reasons why a company would engage, why an industry would routinely engage in this kind of massive criminal behavior where the criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars are common and have been as high as $1 billion. First of all, there's a net profit. You know, the people who make these decisions, you know, you may or may not get caught with any given criminal behavior or other unlawful behavior, but apparently there's either a net profit anyway or collectively between the ones you get caught and the ones you don't get caught, there's a net profit. One way or the other, there's a net profit, or they wouldn't keep doing it. Now, the fines have gotten a lot worse. Does that mean the prosecution is better or that the behavior is worse? Or some combination of the two, ultimately, who knows?
Or the activism is actually starting to get to people. People like you, people like me are actually talking about it.
Well, I do believe that we are in the midst of what some might call an awakening process. But I tell you, we're at an early stage that is still quite painful, because every day that we do not get rid of vaccine mandates and put out complete and truthful information, we have more people who are unnecessarily being injured and killed by them. And that's just the hard reality here.
Yes. Oh, we'll take another quick break here. We'll come back for a longer segment. Talk about the vaccine exemption book, which I think everybody needs to have this. Gosh, everybody needs to be their own advocate. We'll be back.
You are tuned.
And we're back, folks. We are in the National Intel Report. I'm Clint, substituting for Mr. John Stat Miller today, owner extraordinaire of Republic Broadcasting. My guest today, very important guest, Ellen Phillips, who has a book. It is an e-book. It is The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions by Ellen Phillips. Now, you have said something that I hold near and dear to my own heart as a legal researcher myself. You say warning, and I want you folks to listen to this very carefully. People have lost exemption rights by relying on anti-vaccine websites. Even sites from the vaccine book authors and alternative medical doctors have, and I will add a little gumption here, have grave misunderstandings, although you just say misunderstandings. They mean well, but they don't know the law. And I want to stress that very much, because a lot of the things that I uncovered, I had no idea what the law was, or how it dealt with the civil persons of men. I had no idea the notion of being under surety and bondage as a United States citizen, what that actually meant, what that meant for your children, that they follow your status. There's a lot of things that you need to know when it comes to these things, and so you have to be able to apply the law not only to your specific status, public, private, et cetera, but also you must understand what that status actually, what that person actually is. And if you don't, then you're going to make a mistake. It's so easy to misstep, as you know, as an attorney. You know how easy it is to make a misstep in the law, to say the wrong term of art, to say the wrong thing, and end up giving your consent either through silence or through some mishap, some misspoken word, figurative instead of literal meaning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I really want to stress the importance of this statement, that people will lose their exemption rights by relying on some of the alternative, if you will, exemption sites out there, people who are really, truly trying to help people like myself, but who literally don't know the law and how it applies to, again, to our status. And that's very important.
Yeah, and there's a real simple concept that I sometimes use to describe this, that people suffer from what I call the what you don't know that you don't know syndrome. So that is, people operate from a common sense place based on sets of information, and in this arena often sets of assumptions. And many times the assumptions turn out to be wrong, and other times their thinking is fine as far as it goes, but there's other information they're not even aware of that if they did know that other information, they would come to a different conclusion. So let me give you a couple quick examples. During the swine flu pandemic, I heard many people saying over and over again, well, I have a right to decide what to put in my body. And my response to that is, well, we certainly should have a right to decide what to put in our body, but let's see what the law says. Oops, that's not what the law says. We don't have a right to decide what to put in our body, and we should be very upset about that, and we should take steps to change it. And we can work, at least in theory, to get laws passed that would give us those rights. So it's a disturbing situation. And this has been tested in the courts. I heard about a case in South Carolina where a nurse went to court. The employer says, you got to get a flu shot. And she says, no, I have a right to decide what to put in my body. Now, when I heard about the case, I cringed, because I thought, well, my understanding is that's not the case, and I don't see how you could win that case, but I hope she wins, and I'll learn something new out of it. Because I learn stuff all the time, and I'm always open to hearing somebody give me information I didn't know that'll change my mind, and that happens from time to time. Unfortunately, in this particular instance, I was proven right, and she lost her case. So, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean the same case would lose everywhere else in the country. But the point is that we've got to be careful with our assumptions. Another really interesting one, and there are some alternative medical doctors who I just dearly love, but otherwise I love to pick on doctors generally. Although I honestly believe most of them are honest, sincere people who want to do the right thing. Most of them are also misinformed, but that's a secret.
I like to say they're, you know, innocent in the fact that they have no idea they're participating in a death cult.
Yeah, exactly. And I wish I could say those were exaggerating terms, but I've gotten to the point where I just can't. You know, I specifically go out of my way to avoid being sensationalistic, but sometimes there's just no other word for it. You know, the word evil applies here, and I hate that kind of a broad, generalized label, but I just don't know another word for it. Anyway, a few years ago, there were a couple of medical doctors arguing on the internet about whether or not the Bible is opposed to vaccines. And one of them says, well, the Bible's written 2,000 years ago. Of course, it's not against vaccines, which is kind of silly when you think about it, because you could just as easily spin that the other way. Well, the Bible's written 2,000 years ago, so it couldn't be for vaccines. The problem, though, and I love this because I get to pick on both of the doctors this time. The problem is that they're asking the wrong question. The question they're asking is a theological question. Is the Bible against vaccines? There's nothing wrong with theological questions, nothing wrong with people having debates, agreeing, disagreeing, or whatever. You know, that's not an issue. But we're talking about a legal right here. And when you're talking about a legal right, the starting point is a very different question. And the question is, how does the law define religion for legal purposes? Because we can define it any way we want to for our own private purposes. But if you're in an argument with a school, your employer, or somebody else over a vaccine exemption, and if you take that to a formal venue, court or whatever it would be, sometimes there are administrative proceedings or whatever, but you take it to some sort of formal venue, if the system works the way it's supposed to, not always a given, but if it does work the way it's supposed to, it's the law that's going to answer the question. Not your opinion or my opinion about what should or shouldn't be considered religion or religious. And so we got to ask a whole different question. How does the law define religion? And just so you know, to sort of give the short answer, the two doctors who are arguing about the Bible being opposed to vaccines, both doctors' religious beliefs are protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. The law does not try to figure out what the right interpretation of any religion is. So only one of those beliefs is going to get an exemption because only one of them is against vaccines. But otherwise, both beliefs are protected religious beliefs. It's sort of fascinating how broad the law defines religion for legal purposes. It doesn't matter whether you belong to a church or any organized religion at all. It doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do. It's your personal interpretation. This past Valentine's Day, the Pope vaccinated a kid in Mexico City, you know, big photo op. But guess what? In America, if you're a devout Catholic, but your interpretation of Catholicism is that you can't vaccinate, that's a protected religious belief. That qualifies. In fact, you don't even have to have a belief in a Western theological God to qualify. You do have to meet the legal definitions, but it's really broad.
The Black's fourth edition of the Black's Law Dictionary said it really helped me to understand it. It's a very simple concept. There's two forms of religious, you know, concept. There's the action and there's the belief. What you have in your head, what you believe, that's totally up to you. But what Black's Law says is when it comes to the notion of freedom of religion, you have the freedom, the right to believe whatever you want. But what you don't have the freedom to do is act on your moral or religious beliefs if they are opposed to the public law, basically. And so this is why I say it's so important to address the status that you are approaching and appearing in the court There's cases, you know, I can quote all kinds of cases, but there's one in particular, City of Dallas versus Mitchell. The rights of the individuals are restricted only by the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government. So what I see is an epidemic of people trying to put forward their private rights, which they have not reserved in citizenship, in public citizenship. Constitution certainly applies to people who've reserved all their rights. It's a negative document. But people in U.S. citizenship are literally agreeing to all of these laws that we're talking about, and you have to approach it and find the correct, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you have to find the exemptions that apply to U.S. citizens, not private citizens, not this, but specifically what your status is. And those rights are generally, when you're talking about religious or acting upon your religious or moral law, you're in legal law. You're not in your own religion. You're not acting religious. You're acting civilly, and you have to be in that realm. And that's really hard for people, I think.
Well, it certainly is in one aspect a theological question. There's not that theology doesn't have any relevance, but the question of whether your beliefs are protected by law. When we ask or talk about, do I qualify for an exemption? And let's say religious in particular, since we're on that. Do I qualify for a religious exemption? Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. You made a really important distinction between beliefs and actions, because really I don't know of any absolute right except that you can believe whatever you want to believe, but you can't do whatever you want to do. And historically, and presently, the states have always had the right to say, oops, never mind, with respect to a religious exemption to vaccines, if there's some counter need on the part of the state to protect the citizens. Now, the concept is perfectly valid, but where we've really gone far astray is that public health policy in the United States is based on mainstream medicine. Unfortunately, mainstream medicine is pretty severely corrupt, despite having a lot of good people working for it. So if your starting place is a corrupt mainstream medicine, then even when the legal systems do work the way they're intended to, the legislatures and the courts, there's still a pretty good chance that the end result is going to be skewed to one degree or another, and that's what we see, in particular with vaccines. But the concept is otherwise valid, that your ability to exercise your freedom of religion, to act or behave any way you want to in the name of religion, is bounded by the opposing right and, frankly, duty and obligation of the state to protect citizens. So if vaccines really were safe and effective, and if there were some sort of outbreak, for example, or imminent risk, a bioterrorist threat or something along those lines, it would make really good sense for people to be required to either get the appropriate vaccine or to otherwise take action to avoid being exposed or spreading the disease. So the basic concepts there, the underlying concepts are sound, that where one right ends is where it bounds up against an opposing right, and where there's a formal conflict, then the courts have to draw lines and say, where's the proper balance between these opposing rights? And when a state enacts a religious exemption law, for example, and this is even spelled out in some legal precedent in Florida as a case in point, where the court said, this is how the state has balanced the public health need with the free exercise of religion rights of individual parents. And they do that by way of a religious exemption. But in most states, if there's a declared emergency, emergency vaccines can then be ordered, and you don't have a religious exemption or other non-medical exemption. In fact, I even saw one state law that threw medical exemptions out the window.
Well, this is that, maybe you can speak to this, this is that notion of the law of necessity, which necessity knows no law. When you declare an emergency against, I should say a war against the emergency, which is the emergency powers of the president, and the swine flu is that emergency in the war, equals necessity. Necessity thus sort of wipes out any state exemptions that go against that federal emergency. I mean, this is how the system works. It's very horrible But the notion of that, you know, we're at war, and therefore all your exemptions go out the window, we can force you to vaccinate. This is what people need to understand. Again, how does your status relate to what's actually going on with all these different agencies and everything?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different parts and pieces to this. First of all, the federal government does not have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents directly. And this is why the CDC makes recommendations, but it's still up to each individual state to decide what vaccines are required for school and daycare enrollment, what exemptions they're going to allow, what the particular procedure is for the exemptions they do allow. So when the federal government, and it did, declare a swine flu emergency, that didn't result in any state residents automatically losing an exemption or having to get a swine flu vaccine. It could potentially have opened the door for some federal jurisdictions like the military, immigrants, or things like that. But most of us, if we're state residents, are not going to be affected directly by that. But it encourages the states to follow suit.
Right.
And there were states, there were at least, I think, 11 states that declared swine flu emergencies. Virginia declared a swine flu emergency without a single case of swine flu having been documented anywhere in the state.
Yes.
Just a few months ago, Connecticut declared an Ebola state emergency.
Right.
Now, how many Ebola cases do you remember hearing about in Connecticut? You know, there weren't any. And, you know, down in Texas, I think there was one. You know, so this is bizarre, but it's not just something that you shrug and say, gee, that's crazy, because when an emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes, and it changes radically, and it changes whether there really is an emergency or not. It's the declaration that changes the landscape.
And this goes back to your warning, which is, hey, most people do not know the law, and most people approach the law with emotion, and you really can't look at it with an emotional response. You just have to look at it as the way it is. Here's how it's written. Here's how it's interpreted by the courts. That's it. Your opinion means absolutely jack crap, and I hate to say that to people, but that's, you know, you study it long enough, you realize, hey, like you said, your opinion is not going to matter much when it comes to what the practitioners and the magistrates are going to interpret that law as. One of your feedback responses here is, I personally consider vaccine legal exemptions, the title of your ebook, the legal Bible for informed parents of non-vaccinated children, with so many contradictory advice, or with so much, excuse me, contradictory advice on the internet, combined with the very thin line the law allows for vaccine exemptions. This book's exactly what the non-vaccinating parent needs. So why don't you tell people how you can get this, and why, you know, everybody should really have this resource.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Because, first of all, vaccines are required in the U.S. in over a dozen different contexts and subcontexts. They're required at birth, school and daycare, college. There's a whole separate category for at the college level for healthcare curriculums where, for example, nursing students have to do what they call clinical rotations. They work in a local hospital or other health facility, and it's the clinical site that requires vaccines, and the state exemption law doesn't help you there. Then people increasingly are being required to get vaccines at work and in the military, not just military members, but families and civilian contractors, immigration, which includes foreign adoption. I mean, there's just all these different contexts and subcontexts where vaccines are required, and more vaccines being required of more and more people all the time. So there are a lot of different situations that people can be in where they're faced with the question, how do I legally avoid this? Now, as we've mentioned before, there's some misinformation on the internet, and then worse, there is some outright disinformation. That is, people whose job is to confuse and distract us by first convincing us that they're on our side so that we'll put our trust in them. And then once we have done that, they will usually throw out some mixture of accurate and inaccurate information. The accurate information there to suck us in, the inaccurate being as much as they can get away with without us figuring it out, that will mislead and distract us. So it's really, really difficult. Now, there are some situations where to exercise an exemption, you sign a form. You know, you don't need to hire an attorney or buy an ebook for that. But if you do purchase the ebook, you get a really solid background about how the legal system works in sort of general terms. You know, when people say, what's the legal definition of religion? I love that question. Because what they're looking for is an answer that's something like what you're going to read in the dictionary. And the best way that I can give a shortish answer to that question is actually not even quite answering the question directly, but it makes a point. And what I say is, your rights at any given point in time has to do with the way that the specific facts and circumstances in your life at that point in time interact with some combination of state and federal statutes, regulations, legal precedent, and constitutional provisions. So it can really be a complex interrelationship of many different components of law with the particular facts in your life at any given point in time that ultimately determines what your specific rights are in your specific situation. So there are times when you can generalize about law. We have the right to the free exercise of religion, for example, in the Constitution, First Amendment. But what does that mean in any specific situation? You and I don't get to make that up. We have to go look at the legal precedent from court cases. We need to see if there's a statute or, in this case, health department or education department regulation that addresses the issue directly or not. All these different – and this can go at the state and or federal level depending on the particular situation. So
there are options.
Short answer questions.
You have the notion of the contract as well, where the contract makes the law, essentially, or changes the ability or the aspect of being able to get the protections of law. For instance, you know, you can't really be in a tort case in a contractual situation, you know, these types of things. So the contracts that we enter into on a daily basis, the things we agree to and the things we are silent about that we thus agree to, is that sort of contractual relationship, and that affects everything greatly too.
Certainly can factor into it, but it's interesting that because I often get questions where somebody says, well, we live in Tennessee, but our son's going across the border to a summer camp in Kentucky, and they say he's got to have vaccines for the summer camp. Can we exercise, you know, a Tennessee religious exemption because that's where we live? That's an example of a kind of question that comes up where people are not even sure what law they're supposed to even be looking at in the first place. There's a simple answer to that kind of question usually. Like people will live in one state and they're real close to the border and they work in the other state, and in the other state where they work, the employer requires vaccines, you know, that kind of thing, for example. The state isn't concerned with respect to vaccines and exemptions. The state isn't concerned with whether you're a citizen or not. The state is concerned with whether you're a resident, if the situation is fully within one state, or where you're going to school or work, if there's a school or work requirement or whatever. So you might live, you know, if you happen to live, you know, a block away from the border, and you, I don't guess you would really do this. If you lived in one state, you'd probably have to go to a school in that state. But let's say you hopped over the border to a private school or something. You know, you had some situation where you live in one state, but your kid's going to a school, you know, 2 miles away, just happens to be across the border. You're dealing with the law of the state where the school is, not
right. And that's because all states are foreign to each other. Even the individual or several private states are foreign to the United States. So it's just a bunch of foreign. That's why you have that interstate commerce and all that stuff that's so overused. But you'd literally be entering into a foreign state, and you have to follow the foreign rules, the foreign laws.
Yeah, I mean, what it boils down to when you think about it from their point of view, the pro-vaccine, protect public health point of view, they're concerned about the people that are physically within whatever their jurisdiction is, their county or their state or whatever, because that's what's going to theoretically be a concern with regard to the spread of disease. It doesn't matter if technically on paper you live somewhere else. If you're going to go to college here in Wyoming, it doesn't matter if your claimed residence is Florida. You're going to be spending several months at a time here in Wyoming, and you're going to have to follow Wyoming's laws.
Absolutely. Alan Phillips, vaccine Legal Exemptions is the ebook. You can find that at vaccinerights.com. That's vaccinerights.com, and there's all kinds of great information on there. We didn't get to this actual sheet, introduction to the vaccine controversy, which is wonderful, wonderful, just little, you know, little things to talk about. But I sure appreciate you coming on today. I wanted to ask you one final question. Is there, have you come across a situation where people actually, you know, do it the right way? That's a big caveat, of course. Don't let their personal, you know, opinions get in the way. But if you do it the right way, is there anyone out there that cannot find some exemption that will apply to them, aside from the fact that if you have this job, you're going to have a vaccination?
If you approach it correctly from up front, as opposed to diving in on your own to see what happens and then try to, you know, figure out how you get out of it if you've gotten into a mess, then yes, the vast majority of people can be successful in legally avoiding vaccines, but every situation is ultimately unique.
Yeah, we're our own worst enemy when it comes to this type of stuff. So, all right, Alan, thanks so much. Again, Alan Phillips, vaccinerights.com. John will be back tomorrow. Take care, folks.